Hi, this is Sports Jam host Doug Doyle. Bob Porter, Grammy Award-winning record producer, heralded jazz and blues authority and author, legendary WBGO announcer, devoted husband and father, and longtime Boston Red Sox fan, died on Saturday, April 10th at his home in Northville, New Jersey. Bob Porter was 80. The cause was complications due to esophageal cancer, according to his wife, Linda. It was in 2008, the first year of Sports Jam with Doug Doyle, that Bob Porter spoke about his passion for sports and music. Enjoy.
Doug, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's great to see WBGO involved with sports.
I know you and I have wanted to do this session for quite some time. You are such a big baseball fan, specifically a Red Sox fan.
I've been a Red Sox fan since 1946 when they won the pennant but lost the World Series to the St. Louis Cardinals.
Now, tell us about the early days, how you became a Red Sox fan.
Well, my entire family is Red Sox fans. I grew up in the Boston area. And while at that time there were two major league teams in Boston, we were always American League fans, followed the Red Sox. We had a nodding kind of acquaintance and an interest in what the Braves did, but it was always a Red Sox household.
Speaking of a Red Sox household, it's a split household for you now, with your wife Linda being a Yankee fan. How does that all work out, Bob?
Well, my son is also a Yankee fan. I hesitate to mention here. I consider it a major failing as a parent, and I keep reminding him that he's the only person in his family for over 100 years who hasn't rooted for the Red Sox, but that doesn't seem to make any difference. With Linda, it's just a part of our normal relationship, I guess you could say. She doesn't necessarily like anything that I like.
How does that work out when you watch a game then? Are you sitting on the same couch, or how do you handle that?
She keeps telling me to put on the Home and Garden channel.
Now, it's not just the Red Sox that you like. You've also been a Boston Celtics fan since way back. Now, we're talking when the Celtics, big winners this year of the NBA championship, but as far as last time we saw the Celtics being successful was the Bird era, but you go way back to the great days of the Boston Celtics with some of the greatest players of all time.
I'll give you a great story. 1956 was Bill Russell's rookie year. He was, at that time, a member of the United States Olympic team, and he joined the Celtics while the season had already been in progress. The first game he played against the Philadelphia Warriors, they were the Warriors at that time, he went up against the center for the Warriors, the league-leading scorer named Neil Johnson. Neil Johnson was famous for getting a bounce pass into the pivot, and he'd take a fadeaway hook shot, and it was a big shot for him. He averaged like 26, 28 points a game. First time he did it, Russell swatted it out to midcourt, went down and jammed. He blocked four more hook shots from Neil Johnson. And all of a sudden, the rest of the league said, oh, this is how you defend the guy. The next year was his last year, and he was out of the league.
Wow. Now, with you, basketball goes back to when you actually played basketball, and you were actually the sixth man on your high school team. You're a pretty big guy, so center was the spot for you, wasn't it?
Well, actually, center forward, I played, we didn't really have set positions at that point. I mean, you learned what skills you could get away with. But I was a pretty good free throw shooter.
Take us back to maybe one of those games and tell us what you remember about your high school basketball days. And what high school was it?
Well, it was actually a prep school. It was at Wilbraham Academy in western Massachusetts in the town of Wilbraham. I can remember a game when I had 13 points in one quarter. I was on fire. I think I ended up with 17 for the game, but I had 13 in one quarter.
Sports and music, it's in your blood. You're a huge blues man. You've received so many blues awards throughout the years. What first turned you on to the blues?
Well, I think at radio, obviously. In the 1950s, things were not as rigidly formatted on the commercial radio side as they are now. There was virtually no FM in the 50s. And essentially what you did was you searched the dial for that, one station that would give you something. In my case, give me anything that wasn't Eddie Fisher and Doris Day. And I found it. And I found it in rhythm and blues shows and things like that. One of the first disc jockeys I listened to in the Boston area would be somebody who would be recognizable to old New York fans, it was Symphony Sid. Sid did a period of 5 years up in the Boston area during his stints in New York. And he was one of the guys who introduced me to all kinds of jazz and blues. And he would play good vocal groups on his show, too. You'd always hear the Ravens and Orioles on Symphony Sid's show.
How much did winning your first Grammy mean to you?
I had been nominated before, so I knew what the process was. It was, in this particular instance, it was for liner notes. And I was one of two people who did liner notes for a booklet on the complete Charlie Parker on the Savoy label. I had become a Charlie Parker fan early on in my career. Not instantly. Bird was somebody who was accessible to me, but not right away. It took me a while before I really got into him. But by the time I started working for the Savoy label and worked on this particular project, I was really into his music. And I just did a lot of research on it, did a lot of interviewing on it, and I felt very satisfied with the work and very grateful for the fact that it won a Grammy.
Of all the records that you produced, what has meant the most to you, or maybe what was your special one?
Two of them. Gene Ammons was a hero of mine and was probably my favorite tenor saxophone player of the 1960s, 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And I got a chance to work with him in 1969, and this was right after he'd spent 7 years in prison. So I had time to get to know him briefly and then go into the studio with him. And he did a ballad that he had been working on for a while. He had had his horn in prison, so he was able to play. Actually, he even conducted the band at where he was. But he came in with this Jim Webb tune called Didn't We? And when we did it, it just, the musicians were so overwhelmed with it. Bernard Purdy, even then, it was a grizzled studio veteran, jumped off the drums and ran over and gave Gene a big bear hug and lifted him right off the floor. I think Gene was very startled at the time. But, I mean, it was just one of those once-in-a-time, once-in-a-lifetime kind of performances, you know, where everything was just letter perfect.
Now, you mentioned that you had two of them.
The other one was More Today Than Yesterday with Charles Erland. I say Charles Erland because of a mix-up in the way the printer did work on the jacket. His initial album called Black Talk, he was Charles on one side and Charlie on the other side. Now, to all of us who worked with him, he was always Charlie. But because in the his name in the front of the album was Charles Erland, he became Charles Erland to the general public. But More Today Than Yesterday was a tune that went down in one take, and it's over 11 minutes long. And my contribution to that particular performance was to suggest that we don't have any saxophone or trumpet solos on the track, which was probably a good idea. If they had played, we'd probably had a tune that was over 20 minutes long. But More Today Than Yesterday was a huge hit, and for a song that long to become a big radio hit was most unusual. It broke in Philadelphia, but then it broke simultaneously in Detroit and Los Angeles at the same time, and it was really a thrill to see the way a real record breaks and becomes a big, huge record.
for speaking with Bob Porter on Sports Jam. Bob, I don't think everybody really realizes what it means to produce a recording. Can you take us through that process?
Well, let's put it this way. There are different styles of producers. Pop producing is very different than doing jazz records, or in a sense, blues records, too. I've done a little bit of both of them. But take a producer like Creed Taylor. Creed Taylor hears it before he goes into the studio. His specialty was to take a musician and put him in a context which would generally be reserved for a singer, that is to say, orchestral, with strings and woodwinds and things like this. He was very adept at, you know, making great records with Freddie Hubbard and George Benson and Stanley Turrentine and people of that particular vintage, Stan Getz, Jimmy Smith, Cal Jader, Wes Montgomery, in some of his early eras. But it was a question of surrounding the talent with a particular kind of sound. I'm different from Creed in the sense that if I'm doing my work well, it's done before we go into the studio, because I want to make sure that I've got the right band, and I want to be sure that we at least have a direction in mind once we start performing, once the recording starts rolling. Because as far as I'm concerned, I want the guys to play what they want to play, the way they want to play it. Now, I'm there for a second opinion, and I'm not hesitant about, you know, telling guys if I think that the tempo is quite, you know, not quite the way it should be, or if maybe we should change up the solo order or things like that. But in a large measure, I want to capture the sound of the guys playing in the studio.
It's not an easy job, is it?
Well, it can be a great deal of pleasure. It can be also a huge pain in the neck certain times. It depends on how well everything is going. If everybody's on time and feels it and is into it and is happy and relaxed, it can be great. If all of those things are not present, sometimes it can be an enormous headache.
You have two shows here on Jazz 88, and they're somewhat different in their texture and the songs that you play. Do you still enjoy this?
Yes. Portraits and Blues has been going for many years, but it's a taped show. It's done in advance of its airing. Nowadays, I do it live on Friday nights, and we tape that and rerun it Saturday mornings. But for many, many years, it was syndicated across the country. But at the same time, I don't have any contact with the audience when I'm doing that show Friday night. Saturday mornings is different in the sense that the repertoire is different. It's more a rhythm and blues show. And at the same time, I enjoy the contact with the audience. And that's what's really, you know, fun, makes it fun for me. I do miss not being able to play jazz on the air anymore. Of course, I did that here for more than 20 years. And I always enjoyed that. But, you know, I'm happy doing what I'm doing Saturday mornings.
When did you know music was going to be a huge part of your life?
When I was in college, I was spending so much on records, buying records, that I said to myself, I got to figure out a way to make some money back off this what was then a very expensive hobby. So I began writing liner notes and meeting people at various record labels and becoming friendly with them and, you know, things like that. I've done a lot of things through the years in the sense that I've been a trade paper columnist. I've been, you know, I've written hundreds of liner notes as well as producing and doing radio and things like this. So I've managed to keep everything in perspective as long as I can keep it going.
From the years that I've worked with you, when I've done interviews with you about certain artists that you've worked with, you're a real stickler for details. You want to make sure that the right information gets out there, right?
I am most embarrassed when I say something that's wrong on the air. And it's my fault if that happens because, you know, for whatever reason, I got it wrong. And I hate to do that, just as you as a newsman hate to get things wrong. I mean, the basic idea is while you're out there giving people the news, I'm out there giving them information about what they're listening to. And if I make a mistake, I feel terrible about it.
Why do you think that there are so many people that enjoy jazz or blues and also are so into sports?
Well, look, if I had my way on a Saturday night in a strange town, I would head for a sports bar with a good blues band. I would watch the game with the sound off and listen to the music. And I don't think I'm alone in that. It's always seemed to be, if you add a couple of beers and the prospects of watching a game and listening to a band, I mean, for certain of us, that's just about as good as it gets.
We're speaking with Bob Porter, WBGO host, and also Grammy Award-winning producer. Give me your favorite athlete and compare it to someone, if you could, in the blues world or jazz world, and how that comparison would be laid out.
Favorite baseball player, Ted Williams, without question. I saw him in the 50s, perhaps half a dozen times. It got to be that every time I'd go to see him play, he'd hit a home run. I saw him hit a home run off Herb Score and Bob Feller in the same game, the best lefty and the best righty in Cleveland history. I saw him hit a home run off Hoyt Wilhelm. I saw him hit a home run off Jim Bunning. So I saw Williams when he was still great. And now he's in his late 30s by this time, but he's still just the best hitter I ever saw. Comparing him, he is such a perfectionist. I think you would probably compare him to somebody like a Stan Getz, who had an obvious gift and really cultivated it to the point where everything he did was kind of magic.
Watching Ted Williams, if you could have the opportunity to go back into Ted Williams' heyday and watch him perform when he was at the height of his career, or watching a certain performer, how would you split your time? Where would you go? Would you go to a baseball game, or would you go to see a great blues artist?
Well, I would try and do them both. I mean, I don't want to separate something like that. With Williams, it was a question of watching him hit. Now, he was a competent left fielder, but you wouldn't go to a baseball game to watch Ted Williams play left field. You would go to watch him hit, and I think to a certain extent you want the same thing from a good jazz musician or a good blues musician. They don't necessarily do everything equally well, and you would hope to see the artist perform what it is you think he does best and to do it at the best of his ability.
Thus, hitmakers for both sides on the baseball diamonds and in music that you enjoy. We're speaking with Bob Porter, the host of Portraits in Blue and also Saturday Morning Function. And we're also talking about not only his love of sports, but his record-producing career. Is there any artist that you've ever worked with that was just a nightmare?
Yeah, I'm not going to mention who it was.
Oh, come on, Bob, that's what we're here for.
No, you really don't want to hear it, and I don't. And the person involved may well have had reasons for doing what he did to me. But the fact of the matter is this: the producer has to have the artist's interest in mind, as well as the company's interest in mind. I mean, he's the person who's in the middle between the two things. And if I can get everybody on the same page with the same idea to do and have a good idea of what it is we want to accomplish, that's fine. But if I have a guy who calls me up at 2:30 in the morning the night before a scheduled record date and says, "I'm sorry, I'm in Detroit and I'm not coming," that does not tend to endear him to me. I think you understand that.
I do indeed. Now, sports goes all the way back to your parents. I understand that their sport that they were involved in, curling.
They took it up when they were in their 50s, when the kids were grown and out of the house, so to speak. And it was my mother who was really the good curler. And my father took such an interest in it because I think partially because of her abilities. And he became an administrator. He was involved in the Grand National Curling Club and with curling administration both internationally and in the U.S. She was just a terrific shot maker as a curler. And curling is a sport that is, I believe, Scottish in origin and is probably best known in the northern parts of the country. Canadians are wonderful curlers. They always have the best teams. They are usually in the Olympic finals. And I enjoy it watching it on television. I'm probably the only person who does, but when they use the overhead cameras and you can see the stones rolling down the ice, you know, it's quite interesting.
Plus, you understand the game, and that in itself sometimes is difficult. If you don't understand it and don't play it, then we have a tendency here in America to just kind of blow it off.
Well, look, I mean, as I say, my parents took up curling. I play bridge. Bridge is my way to, you know, get involved competitively in things I do outside my world. It's a way to exercise the brain, and I play a lot of bridge tournaments. I travel to tournaments, not as much as I used to, but still do it once or twice a year.
So the competitive juices flow. You are a competitive guy, aren't you?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I want to be the best at what I do, and I would hope that whoever I'm competing against wants to do the same thing.
You've received, as we mentioned, a number of Blues Awards. Any of those stick out that, you know, that are really on your mantle at home, that you say when somebody walks in, this is the one I'd like to show them?
I don't necessarily do that. The two Grammy Awards are out and on display, but some of the other stuff is hidden away someplace. It was especially rewarding for me to be honored by the Blues Heaven Foundation in Chicago, because that's something that Willie Dixon and his family are behind. And, you know, that was a very nice award to be given by them, recognizing, you know, what I've done to try and keep the Blues alive.
Your wife, Linda, sometimes joins you on the air, and you have quite a dynamic between the two of you. Would you like to refer to her as your coach?
No.
I had a feeling you would say that.
Well, she's a lot of things. She's not my coach.
Tell us about how that relationship developed.
We both worked for Ahmet Erdogan. I was working for Atlantic in the late 80s. I was actually in a very good position there in the sense that I reported directly to him. And I had two tasks. One was to try and retrieve masters, some of which may have been lost in a fire. And the second thing was to help him restore the black music catalog at Atlantic, which had fallen out of favor for much of the 1980s. I started there in 1986. Linda started there in 1988. And we started going out shortly after that. I think the first thing we went to was the WBGO event at Carnegie Hall, which featured, among others, Albert Collins. She'd never seen Albert Collins before and was thrilled. But it got to be that we could talk to each other about things that we couldn't talk to anybody else about because, you know, we both worked for the chairman of Atlantic and those kind of things. As I say, there's a lot of high-priority stuff that you really couldn't mention to anybody else.
Being a Red Sox fan, a lot of people say, well, maybe he's a casual. No, you're a diehard Red Sox fan for the fact that you know averages of players, you know the new players, you know the history of the team. Some of the players that you like a Kevin Youkilis, you know all about him.
Well, it's not just that, Doug. I mean, I'm a baseball fan. If I wasn't a Red Sox fan, I think I'd still be a baseball fan. I mean, I get the cable package that has the Major League Baseball games, and while I watch mostly Red Sox, I'll look at the Mets, I'll look at the Yankees, I'll look at out-of-town games just to see what's going on. And I pay attention. I read the papers every morning, check the standings, check the batting averages, things like that. I've been doing it since I was a kid.
What do you think are the Red Sox chances in the playoffs now?
The Angels are going to be the difficult team for anybody to beat. It may simply be their year. They just seem to be playing with a lot of confidence.
What do you like about the Red Sox on this team right now that could get them to another World Series championship?
I like their balance. They seem to have good ball players at every position. They have, I think, the best starting pitching of anybody in the American League. And if their bullpen can get it together for the 7th, 8th, and if you can get me to Jonathan Papelbon in the 9th inning, I'll put my money on him.
Before the Red Sox had that miracle comeback against the Yankees and won the World Series championship, everyone kind of became a Red Sox fan and kind of felt the pain. Now that the Red Sox have gone on to be the dominant team now of the 2000 era, is it just as fun now that you're winning, or was there a little magic for the fact that the Red Sox couldn't get over the hump?
I remind everybody that the Red Sox were the dominant team in the early part of the 20th century, in the same way that they are in the 21st century. They won six different pennants between 1903 and 1918. You know, so this is not new. It just took them 100 years to get back to it again.
What did you feel like when the Red Sox did come back and beat the Yankees when they were down 3-0?
I am somebody who, when things get very, very close to completion, I get very nervous. I happened to be at Jazz at Lincoln Center the night that they won the World Series, and we repaired to an Irish bar on 57th Street when I realized that the game was still going on. And I watched it long enough to watch Keith Foulke get that comebacker and underhand it to first base and to wrap up the championship. And that was very great. I was very grateful. But I would have been a nervous wreck trying to watch the game.
Where are you going to watch the playoffs this year?
Oh, at home. I'll certainly watch them. I think I've become more, as I get older and I'm kind of semi-retired at this stage, I have more time to watch baseball. And I find more to get out of watching the game. All the time. It's the greatest game of them all. The strategy changes with every pitch.
So if you had a cut, a recording that would symbolize the Red Sox right now, what would it be?
I don't really think of them like that. It's just something that's separate from me. But, you know, they're doing, well, Charlie Erlin's great song, More Today Than Yesterday. They're doing more for me today than they used to do.
Bob, what would you like to tell us about the connection between sports and music?
I think they're things that you can enjoy throughout your whole life, whether you're a kid or whether you're, getting up there in years. The great pianist Jackie Byard used to say that the earlier children are introduced to jazz, the longer they'll stay with it. I think it's true today, and that's why I love the idea that the WBGO gets involved with all these children's programs, because that's the best way to introduce kids to music, is to get them while they're young.
What was the moment that you said, you know, everything that I've done is worth it when it comes to the music career that you've had? What was the moment that you said, yep, it's all been worth it?
I'm not so sure that there was any single moment, but like anybody else, I think, for you do what you do, and you do it as well as you can for whoever is paying you to do it. And then all of a sudden you wake up one morning and you realize that, hey, I've had a career. This is what I've been doing all these years, and it adds up to something. And from that point forward, I think you treat things a little bit differently. You want to make sure that what you do is done properly and is done with a certain amount of class and distinction. And so that will make up for any mistakes you made when you were younger.
Would you have given up this career for an opportunity to maybe play center field for the Red Sox?
I'm a much better spectator than I am a participant. The exception to that would be playing bridge. Bridge is something, as I told you before, that's something that I enjoy playing and participating in. But I could never. I'm the dedication you have these days, the trainings and all the workouts that you have to go into to be a world-class athlete, that's not me. You know, I'd be more likely to say, hey, screw it, let's go to a movie.
You'd bury me if we were playing bridge, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Bob Porter, thanks so much for joining us on Sports Jam.
Hey, Doug, a lot of fun. I think it's a great feature and more power to it.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. I'm Doug Doyle. Our hearts go out to Bob Porter's wife, Linda, and the family. Bob was an iconic voice at WBGO, and our sports chats over the years were always insightful and real. We'll miss you, Bob. Your presence will live on forever at WBGO. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.